Today is Tuesday, January 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Criticism of U.S. President Donald Trump continues a day after audio was released from a call with state election officials.
Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee that the call wasn't helpful.
Plus a look at the state of U.S. African foreign policy.
I would expect that President Biden will visit Africa and that he will host African heads of state.
And a Cold War grandmaster choreographs the Queen's Gambit. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump is just plain wrong about election irregularities in Georgia, according to the state's top elections official on Monday, after he rebuffed Trump's plea over the weekend to find enough ballots to upend his pivotal 11,000 vote loss in the state to President-elect Joe Biden.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
Gabriel Sterling, one of Georgia's top election officials, addressed the controversy with reporters Monday afternoon.
We have certified this election, so there are no more votes to find. And we will continue investigations. So he has an election challenge. And one of the things that they were discussing on that phone call was they have sued the state of Georgia and the Secretary of State. There are rules of evidence to follow once you do that. Trying to go outside of that is an issue. And our lawyers saying, if you want to dismiss your challenge, we're more than happy to share this data with you to show that your data is incorrect and you have, in fact, lost the state of Georgia.
Ken Bredemeyer has been following this story for the VOA newsroom, and he spoke to me on his mobile phone, which unfortunately cut out from time to time.
President claimed that when he goes to Georgia Monday night to campaign for two Senate Republican incumbents who are facing their runoff election on Tuesday, that he will provide what he called the real numbers of the election. That has, of course, been disputed in Georgia, and the state Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, was on the morning talk shows and said that the president is just plain wrong about possible election fraud in Georgia. You have to keep in mind that there was the initial count in Georgia and then two recounts. And all three of them showed that Joe Biden won the election in the state and, of course, got the state's 16 electoral votes.
If, in fact, you know, there were a change in the electoral count in Georgia, it wouldn't be enough to change the results of the election because President-elect Joe Biden has more than the 270 electoral college votes that are requisite to become the next White House occupant.
That's certainly correct. It's 306 to 232 is the prospective electoral college vote count that Congress is going to certify on Wednesday.
As you mentioned, the president is going to Georgia on Monday evening to hold what the White House is calling a victory event for these senators who are running off for ultimately control of the Senate on Tuesday. What has been the response from other congressional members and other officials within the United States government, both present and past?
There's been widespread nation of President Trump's call for the Georgia election officials find votes that he didn't have in order to upend the loss that he had to Biden in the state. No one has come out and said this was a good thing that Trump did. Of course, Democrats were particularly vocal in opposing it, but they weren't the only ones. One of President Trump's biggest supporters, Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, told the Fox News show, Fox and Friends, this morning, that the call wasn't helpful. That's certainly one of the milder statements. At the very least, officials have said, no, this was not proper.
VOA's Ken Bredemeyer. As Ken mentioned, President Trump traveled to Georgia on Monday to hold what the White House press office called a victory rally ahead of Tuesday's runoff election that will determine control of the U.S. Senate. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is in the southern state and gave me this preview.
So I've been here in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dalton, kind of the northern part of the state, going around into the suburbs, talking to some of the voters who really flipped this election for President-elect Biden, and really trying to get a sense of whether or not those normally Republican voters in this usually Republican state are going to flip blue again when they choose their Senate seats. You know, conventional wisdom is that American voters try to keep a balance of power in their government, but if they have a Democrat in the White House, they try to keep a Republican Congress and vice versa. But really, in this polarized political environment today, anything is up for grabs. It's really hard to say what voters are feeling and thinking, particularly when the president is alleging election fraud here in Georgia. So that's even further muddying the waters. What everybody across the board is saying is that this unprecedented pair of Senate runoff elections is really going to decide the future of the country. Some people are even saying decide the future of the country for the next 50 to 100 years. Regardless of what side you're on, you really understand that the stakes here couldn't be higher.
This race will determine who has control of the U.S. Senate. So what are the polls predicting? Where are the candidates sitting this night before the election?
Boy, this has been a razor-thin race, and we know that already because we're in this situation with the runoffs, because no candidate could command a majority in the way that Georgia's system works. So you have all of these concerns about election fraud. Georgia election authorities here are going to be really carefully counting each and every vote, as they did after the November presidential election. As anxious as people are to find out the final makeup of the U.S. Senate, I think we're going to have to wait a little bit longer to make sure that everything here is above board, that everybody's vote has been counted, and it might once again come down to very close margins, because ultimately Georgia is a changing state. The suburbs are turning Democratic, but there's a lot of the country out in the rural areas here that are still staunchly Republican.
Now, you're out there in Dalton where the president is speaking Monday evening, and you had an opportunity to speak with some prospective voters. What are they saying about the election?
That's right. They're incredibly worried that Democrats will win these Senate seats. They told us that they felt that if Democrats assumed control of the U.S. Senate, there would be socialism, that President Biden's agenda would be put through in ways that would possibly raise their taxes, that would take away their guns. All of these concerns that they feel the country is very radically changing from the view they have of it and the view that they wanted to see President Trump enact in a second term. So even though the president is telling them that there's election fraud in Georgia, everyone I spoke to said that they had already voted or we're planning to vote Tuesday. And of course, we know those numbers bear that out. A record number, 3 million Georgia voters have already participated in early voting. This has been a massive, massive interest and outreach, and just Georgia voters understand that the eyes of the entire nation are on them right now.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent, and she was speaking to me from Dalton, Georgia. Israeli officials said Monday that they will not allow Iran to produce a nuclear weapon. Israel was responding to Iran's announcement that its scientists have resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity. The exchange is increasing tensions just 2 weeks before U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is set to take office. Linda Gradstein takes things from here.
Iran's state-run news agency quoted a government spokesman as saying that Iranian President Hassan Rouhani had given the order to resume enriching uranium to 20% purity at the underground Fordo facility. The move is seen as a significant step toward achieving weapons-grade levels of uranium. In the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran agreed not to go above 4%. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the Iranian decision shows that Iran is seeking nuclear weapons despite its denials, and that Israel would not allow this to happen. Giora Eiland, the former head of Israel's National Security Council, said the move is a significant step forward for Iran in its quest to become a nuclear power.
And as far as we know today, beginning of 2021, they do not have a nuclear bomb, although they have actually all the access and all the potential to have it if they make a decision to try to get it in a period of less than 6 months or less than a year.
But Island said he saw the Iranian announcement more as a way to put pressure on the incoming Biden administration to return to the Iran nuclear deal from which the Trump administration withdrew.
Today, they accelerate very carefully this process in order to create some pressure on the United States in order to be in a better position when the dialogue begins, as they believe in a matter of a few months.
The Iranian announcement comes 1 year after the United States targeted killing of senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander Qassem Soleimani, a move Iran has vowed to avenge. It also comes just 2 months after senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was gunned down in Tehran, allegedly by Israel. Analysts like Riza Shayed, a journalist with France 24 based in Tehran, point to a possible link between the Iranian announcement and the killing of Soleimani.
There's been a lot of talk in Washington in recent days that Iran plans to launch an attack against U.S. interests to memorize that assassination. There's no evidence that that's going to happen, but this could be, this move today, Iran's way of delivering a blow to the Trump administration, saying this is the result of your maximum pressure campaign, and it could be a way of honoring the passing of Qasem Soleimani.
Meanwhile, on Monday, Iran seized a South Korean-flagged oil tanker on its way to the United Arab Emirates, saying the ship had violated maritime laws. The move further increased tensions between Iran and Western allied nations. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Elsewhere, a breakthrough has been reached in Qatar's three-year-old dispute with Saudi Arabia and three other Arab countries. An agreement aimed at ending their rift is to be signed in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. The development is the latest in a series of Middle East deals sought by Washington, the others involving Israel and Arab states, aimed at building a united front against Iran. Now, as part of the deal, Kuwaiti Foreign Minister Ahmad Nasser al-Sabah on Kuwait TV said Saudi Arabia will reopen its airspace as well as its land and sea border to Qatar as of Monday. The Saudi state press agency quoted Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as saying that the annual gathering of Gulf leaders on Tuesday would unite Gulf ranks in the face of challenges facing the region. A British judge ruled on Monday that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange should not be extradited to the United States to face charges of breaking a spying law and conspiring to obtain secret U.S. documents by hacking government computers. Reuters' Adam Reed has those details.
Nearly all arguments from Assange's legal team were rejected, but the judge said she could not extradite him because of concerns over his mental health and risk of suicide in the U.S. Assange is accused by American authorities of breaking a spying law and conspiring to obtain secret US documents by hacking government computers. His lawyers had argued that the entire prosecution was a politically motivated move by outgoing US President Donald Trump and that extradition would pose a threat to journalism. There are a total of 18 charges leveled against Assange relating to the publication of leaked military and diplomatic documents detailing alleged U.S. military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The charges could add up to a maximum sentence of 175 years in prison. At a hearing at London's Old Bailey, the judge said Assange suffered from severe depression at times. Half a razor blade was found in his prison cell in May last year, and he told medical staff about his suicidal thoughts. Medical conditions. Jennifer Robinson is Assange's lawyer.
This is an important win and a ruling that should be celebrated. But let's not forget that she also made some very problematic findings on the free speech aspects of this case.
The case is now likely to go to the UK Supreme Court, while Assange's legal team confirmed it will apply for bail. In the meantime, he will remain at London's Belmarsh Prison, where he's been held since April 2019. U.S. prosecutors immediately stated they will appeal Monday's decision.
Adam Reed reports for Reuters News. And coming up later,
world chess champion Garry Kasparov was supposed to play the Soviet grandmaster Borgov in the show. But instead, he choreographed all the games in the show. He says the games are all real. Kasparov controlled every single one of them.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say between 10 to 100 trillion microorganisms, some good and some bad, live inside our digestive systems. A new study by researchers at Oregon State University suggests that they have identified a few organisms in this collection of bacteria that could lead to possible treatments of type 2 diabetes and obesity. According to the Mayo Clinic, type 2 diabetes is a chronic condition where the body either doesn't produce enough of or resists the effect of the hormone insulin to maintain normal levels of glucose, a type of sugar that provides fuel for the body. After an analysis, the Oregon team found four species of gut bacteria that appear to affect the breakdown of glucose. Two of these microbe species were found to improve, and two were found to worsen the metabolism of glucose. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. As a new year begins and a new American presidential administration prepares to take office, relations between the United States and Africa have never been more complex or potentially more promising. For a broad look at where things stand and what to expect with respect to American foreign policy toward the continent in terms of aid, security, and other matters, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Campbell, who was the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria between 2004 and 2007, began by stressing the continuity of relations between the United States and Africa over the past two decades, despite President Trump's public pronouncement of substantial change.
The often fierce rhetoric from the president about making significant cuts in various programs that benefit Africa. Virtually none of them happen, largely because of bipartisan congressional opposition.
Which programs do you have in mind?
For example, Power Africa, an initiative of the Obama administration designed to increase the production of electricity in Africa, that has continued. The Young African Leadership Initiative, also an Obama program designed to groom young people for leadership positions in Africa. That has continued. And PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, a Bush initiative, has continued. And then President Trump's signature initiative with respect to Africa was designed to make American investment in Africa easier. That is just being rolled out now.
The truth is that for many Americans, Africa seems incredibly far off. In simple terms, can you explain why Americans should care about American policy toward Africa at all?
Well, let's start with demography. There are a great many Africans, and there are going to be a great many more of them in the relatively near future. Let's take a specific example. Nigeria at present has 205 million people. By mid-century, 30 years from now, it is anticipated that the population will exceed that of the United States, and that it will be, in fact, the third largest country in the world by population. That should provide new markets and opportunities for investment and for general increase in economic links. Then let's move on to security, particularly in the Sahel and in West Africa. Jihadi groups are active, seeking to overthrow governments that are friendly to us. They're deeply hostile to the United States, and while they do not at present pose a threat to American security, they certainly pose a threat to American interests, and they may pose a threat to American security in the future.
And then there is the general movement toward democracy in Africa,
which Americans, almost all Americans, support and favor. Some African countries very much have a democratic trajectory that is positive. You put all that together, and we should be paying a great deal more attention to Africa than we have in the past, not as a matter of charity,
or assistance or aid, but simply because of our own interests.
What about American diplomacy toward Africa in the incoming Biden administration?
I find it interesting that President-elect Biden's choice for American ambassador to the UN, probably our most important diplomatic position, that he has tapped Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a career diplomat who specialized in Africa and was ambassador to Liberia.
Of course, aid is a big part of America's policy toward the continent.
But I would caution here, the American economy is challenged. The incoming administration does not have as much money as I suspect many Africans assume it will have. I think in the shorter term, where the difference will be quite clear is in rhetoric and in atmosphere. There will certainly be an end to disparaging comments about Africa that have come out of the White House. I would expect that President Biden will visit Africa and that he will host African heads of state. These are matters of symbols, but symbols are extremely important.
John Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. The vaccination drive against the coronavirus is entering a new phase. The first Americans inoculated against COVID-19 have begun rolling up their sleeves for their second and final dose. New York State, meanwhile, has announced its first known case of the new and seemingly more contagious variant detected in a man in his 60s in Saratoga Springs. Colorado, California, and Florida previously reported cases of the mutant version that has been circulating in England. Britain has introduced another vaccine, even as Prime Minister Boris Johnson imposes another nationwide lockdown against the rapidly surging virus.
You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance, such as getting a COVID test, or to escape domestic abuse.
There have now been more than 85.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 around the world. Iranian media have said the Revolutionary Guards Corps seized a South Korean flagged tanker in Gulf waters and detained its crew amid tensions between Tehran and Seoul over Iranian funds frozen in South Korean banks due to U.S. sanctions. Seoul confirmed the seizure of a South Korean chemical tanker by Iranian authorities in the waters off Oman and demanded its immediate release. Even before the hit Netflix series The Queen's Gambit aired on television, the COVID-19 pandemic had sparked more interest in the game of chess. In this story narrated by Anna Rice, Elena Wolf talks about the game with Russian grandmaster Garry Kasparov.
The meteoric rise in the popularity of this ancient battle royale has a lot to do with the popularity of The Queen's Gambit, a hit Netflix show about the rise of a troubled chess prodigy.
It's an amazing show. It was super fun. That's what drew me to this, because I just finished watching it last night.
This is the biggest thing since 50 years. Fischer against the Russians in Reykjavik. The last time this country saw this madness, or what we call chess fever.
Americans have always had a complex relationship with chess, in part because it was one small battlefield of the Cold War between Russia and the United States. In 1972, the American Bobby Fischer won a game dubbed the Game of the Century when he beat the Soviet chess champion Boris Spassky. The Netflix show The Queen's Gambit is something of a retelling of that story. It focuses on an orphaned girl from Kentucky who beats her own demons and an unbeatable Soviet grandmaster in a game that transcends the decades-long conflict between the two great superpowers.
The antagonists, the Soviet chess champions, are depicted very warmly. There's no extra conflict added to the show about the Cold War, about fighting. There's no mean-spiritedness.
World chess champion Garry Kasparov was supposed to play the Soviet grandmaster Borgov in the show, but instead, he choreographed all the games in the show. He says the games are all real. Kasparov controlled every single one of them.
It was a question of prestige for me. I knew that my colleagues would be watching the show very closely, watching every game. And I promised myself that they wouldn't have anything to criticize, that each game would be perfect.
Even the chess figures the orphan Beth Harmon conjures on her ceiling are not just the show's invention.
In reality, chess players, when they think about chess, even during a game, oftentimes there are chess players who actually literally look up at the ceiling and are calculating variations.
American-Hungarian Susan Polgar became a grandmaster at the age of 15.
I was never involved with alcohol or drugs or lived a lifestyle as Beth Harmon. But I, of course, have been told a lot worse thing, and including sexual harassment and including physical intimidation. But, you know, verbal abuse was just an everyday thing, you know, that girls can't play chess, you know, girls don't belong in chess, go play with dolls, not with chess. Chess is for guys. Women are not as smart as guys.
The show, however, focuses on the idea that the game of chess is humane and eternal. And even in the middle of the Cold War, there's room for warm embraces.
The last scene in the show, she goes to the boulevard where men are playing chess.
Lisa Harmon. Over 50 movies have been made about chess, but not many manage to make the game look so human and warm and fun. For Eliana Wolf in Florida, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is taking steps to prevent the Cuban regime from financially exploiting its own people and using the funds to support the illegitimate government of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro. The country's government uses two particularly ugly methods to get its hands on hard currency. It steals remittances, monetary gifts from relatives and friends living outside of Cuba, from its own citizens. Cuba is the only country in the hemisphere where the military takes a cut of remittances, said Acting Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs Ambassador Michael Kozak at a recently held special briefing on human rights concerns in Cuba. The Cuban military seizes hard currency for its own purposes, using it to fund its interference in Venezuela and prop up its own failing business ventures. They also then take their cut and force the Cuban individuals to use what remains of their remittance funds to only buy goods at marked-up prices from regime-controlled stores. To stop this practice, the United States blocked the Cuban armed forces from manipulating the processing of remittances. At the same time, the United States leaves space for remittances to continue to flow through private and civilian channels. The United States also raises international awareness of the second method the Castro government uses to obtain hard currency, through abuse of medical professionals participating in the overseas Cuban medical missions. This is a profit-making enterprise that is the number one source of income for the Castro regime, said Ambassador Kozak. The regime deprives its own medical personnel of up to 90% of their salaries, salaries that the doctors earn but never see. The United States works to protect the doctors while cutting off this revenue to the regime. Countries that host Cuban workers should directly deposit the professional salaries in their own personal bank accounts instead of filling the regime's coffers. And some countries have demonstrated that this can be done despite regime resistance, said Acting Assistant Secretary Kozak. We have focused on denying the Castro regime the resources it uses to fund its repression in Cuba and its malign interference in Venezuela. And we've done this through targeted sanctions on the Cuban military, security, and intelligence institutions, he said. We aim to strengthen Cuba's civil society and private sector, but not the repressive Cuban regime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.